Picture a winding narrow road. It snakes its way through pristine wilderness in far northeastern Minnesota. After roughly 60 miles, it dead ends where water and woods meet the country's northern border with Canada. This is the Gunflint Trail, abundant wildlife, lakes, and rocky terrain. Before it became a paved road, it was a footpath made by the region's native people. It's a wild place, best known these days for the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness that surrounds it on both sides. It's been singled out for wilderness preservation and has become a place where thousands of people go each year to escape the fast pace of modern life. It's remote and quiet in a way that's hard to come by these days. But it certainly wasn't always prized for its quietness. In fact, there was a time when the Upper Gunflint Trail was thought of very differently. A time when it teemed with prospectors in search of minerals, timber, and really any way to make a buck off the forest and land.
To live in this time in this area, the end of the Gunflint Trail, well, I imagine there was an amazing amount of interesting characters.
Lee Johnson is an archaeologist with the Superior National Forest.
You had a lot of trappers and a lot of speculators, a lot of lumber speculators who were out looking around for valuable white pine. And as today, you know, those people that are drawn, I think, to the frontier or the, what at the time was a frontier we call, you know, the wilderness now, were interesting in their own right. I think, just some very interesting characters and some amazing stories probably.
Mineral prospecting took off in the mid-1800s at a feverish pace, with mining ventures going strong in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and parts of southern Ontario. Many white prospectors were eager to stake claims on the North Shore.
Let's take a look at Cook County in the 1850s and the 1860s and the 1870s. Prior to the Treaty of 1854 with the local Ojibwe bands up here, mineral speculation really was illegal in what is now Cook County.
Fueled by a fury to reap benefits from the land through mining, the U.S. government tried repeatedly to get the area's tribal leaders to sign a treaty opening up Indian lands on the shore and throughout northern Minnesota to white settlers and prospectors. Eventually, the government prevailed. In 1854, the area's seven Indian chiefs signed on to an agreement that opened up a number of northern Minnesota counties to white settlement, including all of Cook County. Atticus, the leader from Grand Marais, was the last one to sign on to the treaty. He believed the annuity payments promised by the government were inadequate. Records of those payments, made after the treaty was signed, show that each Indian person, man, woman, or child, received just $3.53. With the floodgates open, prospecting and mining took off at a pace that could probably be best described as hysterical. In fact, some prowlers didn't wait for the treaty to be signed. Accounts of the time show that some explorers snuck in early and illegally, while others stood by, ready to land ashore in Grand Marais the moment the Treaty of 1854 was signed. One of the more incredible stories from this frenzied time of exploration in the late 1800s is the story of the Paulson Mine and the Port Arthur Duluth and Western Railway. It's almost hard to grasp in today's context, but an iron mine was established near Gunflint Lake, 50-some miles up the trail from Grand Marais.
Well, of course, failures don't often become icons. The Paulson Mine didn't, as far as I know.
Eleanor Barr lives in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and wrote a book on the railroad that used to run from Thunder Bay down to the Paulson Mine on the Gunflint. And Eleanor's right. Failures don't often make the history books, and that makes this a difficult story to tell. It's hard to find all the pieces, because some of the story's been lost over time. But there are bits here and there, and it's an important story, one that ought to be told. It's part of the story of this place, a snapshot of our history. At its peak, during the late 1880s and early 1890s, a small community sprung up around the Paulson Mine. Most folks lived on the north side of Gunflint Lake. Eleanor Barr.
I think in my book, during construction, I say there were 350 people living in the Gunflint area. Prospectors, most of them were coming and going. Loggers, prospectors, the families working in the mines. It was very rough, very, very rough. They lived in log cabins. Most of them had dirt floors. In the wintertime, the moss that chinked the log cabins would fall out or blow out, and the snow would come in. People had to carry their water. I mean, it's just normal for that period that ladies wore long skirts for some reason when they, most of the time they were trying to walk through mud. And, of course, children, no medical facilities, often insufficient bedding and clothing. It was tough, very hard. We owe a lot to our pioneers.
There was a lot of folks who were eking out a living or trying to make it big, trying to hit the copper or the silver vein, or to have a really good winter on the trap line, you know. Of course, there wasn't resorts. There wasn't really cabins in the density we talk about or we see now. The Gunflint Trail would have been, you know, to now we're down in Grand Marais, we're going to head up the Gunflint Trail for the afternoon or just for an hour, you know, it takes us an hour or whatever to drive to the end of it. That would have been a pretty big undertaking in the 1890s, you know, to go up by horse and wagon. I mean, you probably have to be prepared to fix your wheel and your wagon two or three times. And it would have been very different from today. And just if you can put your mind in the context of that period, you know, folks, that this is really before the conservation movement, or right kind of at the same time, but the folks that were up here, there wasn't that thought of wilderness at that time. You know, those folks who were up there, it was livelihood. It was getting through the winter. It was trying to have employment.
It was a harsh existence, especially for laborers who built the railway down from Canada across the border to the Paulson mine. It's a sad story, really. A lot of effort and money were put into the building of the line through to the American side. And in the end, the mine closed just months after the railroad was complete.
Well, the railroad started off the Port Arthur, Duluth, and Western, which became affectionately known as the Poverty, Anguish, Despair, and Want, partially based on how difficult it was to build. And I think probably its story, too, that it didn't last very long on the Minnesota side. It was a Canadian venture to begin with.
The principal investors in the Paulson mine on the Minnesota side were John Anderson Paulson and Kristen Corkgaard. They were able to convince the Canadians to build the line through the U.S. border.
They're like, hey, we got this mine that's going to be productive down here, south west of Gunflint Lake. Let's hook up with that Port Arthur, Duluth, and Western and get it built into our mine. That way we can get our product, our ore out to the lake, and it can go to refineries or smelters down in the southern Great Lakes area.
The line was about 90 miles long when it was finished. It was a lot of work to build. Most of the labor fell on the backs of Italian immigrants.
The railroad itself, from what the historic records say, was primarily Italian workmen, 250 of them that built the line. And that's probably very indicative now if you go to Thunder Bay and you look at the real predominant immigrant communities. They're still, you know, the Finns and the Italians are still very predominant in Thunder Bay.
Did you know that there were four bake ovens along the PD on the north shore the workers were mostly Italian, and that's where they baked their bread or pasta or whatever they baked in them.
Building the railroad was hard. The landscape near the border is extremely rugged, especially on the American side. There are big rocky bluffs, lots of lakes and streams, and some major changes in elevation. Tom Caffeen works for the U.S. Forest Service. He's been fascinated by the story of the mine and the railroad since the 80s.
It cost $16,000 a mile to build this railroad on the Canadian side. It cost $40,000 on the American side just because of how rough the terrain is. There's a lot of trestle building, a lot of rock blasting, so it was quite expensive to do.
All that money and effort, and when all was said and done, one load of ore was all that ever made it out of the Paulson mine. It's especially sad when you look at everything that was sacrificed to build it. Although investors felt the impact in their pocketbooks, it could probably be said that workers suffered the most.
it was really important for trains, for the gradient of a train track to stay below like 3%. So if you get to a big rock cliff or a rock wall and your line's running, you have to go through it, you know, or build some sort of trestle to keep that 3% grade. So there was a lot of dynamite work done, and we can imagine that these guys were pretty good at what they were doing. Although the story is that Joseph Montaguin, there was some dynamite charges being set off, and what you do is you drill holes to set the charges, hand drills mostly, and in this case the charge didn't go off. They dropped the dynamite down it, and the charge didn't go off. So Joseph went up to mitigate that by pouring water down the hole, and the charge went off and killed him. And co-workers, the other folks that were out there working with him, couldn't accompany his body to Port Arthur. And whether that was a call that was the superintendent made, he's like, no, we have a deadline on this line. You have to keep working. His body will go back to Thunder Bay, but no one can go with him.
His co-workers carved a cross in the black rock right where a person would sitting in the train would be able to see it as they passed through.
And that's still there. You can see it. It's on the Canadian side of Gunflint.
I felt shivers when I first saw that cross.
But these cruel times were not without some kindness. There was a person who came to be quite relied upon in the community, someone who made an extra effort to help those in need.
Margaret Matthews was a businesswoman, one of the few business women that could function in the society at the time. She was a madam. She had brothels scattered throughout the district.
Meg, as she was often called, opened a brothel near the Paulson Mine. She was as famous for her establishment and its services as she was for her desire to help those in need.
She acted as the welfare department for this city. She made a lot of money, and she made sure it got back to the poor people. She's like Roberta Hood.
Meg was granted the first liquor license ever in Cook County.
And this establishment, Meg Matthews' establishment, probably, you know, served a lot of the men that were working on the rail line, a lot of the mining speculators that were passing through to go up in the border country, trappers, and probably whoever was employed working at the Paulson Mine in those years, 1885, 1893.
I think she must have been a remarkable lady. Just to start her own business, not paying too much attention to what it was. What was open for women to do in those days? That was the only business where you could earn a decent living. She spent a lot of time getting raided, I understand, by the police. But after a while, she wasn't raided as often.
Meg was known to be a champion of the people.
She treated her girls very well, from what I understand. They were given time off during each month to go to a place of relaxation, like a holiday place. And this was right across the Cam River from my grandmother's farm. My mother pointed it out to me because she had trained as a nurse, and she nursed Meg's husband through an illness. From what I've read, Meg was about the only social welfare worker in the whole city. People went to her if they needed money to pay for a funeral, for example. And she usually came forward. She was helpful in many community activities that the that were not supported by the city. There was no welfare then, nothing. If you lost your husband and he happened to be working for a company that had a company house, you also lost your house. You and your children had to find somewhere else to live. It was a cruel time. And Meg could be depended on to try and help. She didn't have unlimited resources, but she, from what I hear and from what I've read in documents, these things don't often reach documents, you know. But from what I've heard from other people and from what I've read in the documents, she was a mainstay for people in trouble.
No one knows for certain why Meg took it upon herself to help people, but Eleanor attributes it to Meg's own life experience.
I think she'd had a hard life, and I think she had crossed bridges herself that she was watching other people having to cross. And she was a very clever lady. She was well aware that there was no safety net for people.
Meg's brothel up the trail folded around the same time as the Paulson mine. Turns out the ore wasn't high enough quality to turn a profit for investors. Shortly after the mine closed, major financial panic set in across the country.
The financial panic of 1893 was the largest financial collapse in American history at that time. It was huge. You know, overnight in July, you know, there was a run on the banks and there was a huge mortgage crisis. And that was all centered around railroad overbuilding and shaky financing associated with railroads.
Lee has a theory, and it's one worth considering, that perhaps the founders of the Paulson mine, John Paulson and Christian Korkgaard, were never really that interested in the iron ore mining side of the business venture. He even thinks it's possible, and maybe even likely, that they knew all along the ore wasn't going to be worth much.
I think a lot of investors latched on to railroads as a way to make their money. Okay, we got a line. Here's a great stand of white pine timber out here. Here's a mine that we think is going to pan out. Let's organize capital. Let's build a rail line to it. And then, you know, our part is done. We built the rail line and, you know, we've made our money. And for me, when I was researching this in 2007 and 2008, it was at the same time that the real estate market was collapsing here in the United States. And, you know, you talk about history and, okay, you know, if we don't learn our history, it's bound to repeat itself. For me, it was one of those situations like, wow, I'm reading this and I'm like, wow, this sounds a lot like what's going on now. You know, the bubble burst with, you know, housing developments going in, shaky financing, kind of bunk mortgages. And I'm reading this and like, this is the same thing. Just remove the housing market and replace railroads. And it's very similar.
There's really no denying that Korkgaard and Paulson were a bit shady in their business dealings. A look back at the county's land records, and you can see how they shifted land ownership and titles around regularly, putting investments in and out of their wives' names. As Bill Raff, a well-respected local historian, observed, Korkgaard and Paulson were involved in all kinds of legal maneuverings and shenanigans. Korkgaard even spent time in prison for embezzling money he then invested in the Paulson mine and railroad venture.
The State Bank of Minneapolis, of which Korkgaard was president, goes bankrupt in August of 1893. That was one of those banks in Minnesota that folded due to the run on the banks and whatnot. Korkgaard was arrested that November of 1893. This is roughly 3 or 4 months after the financial panic, and sent to Stillwater for embezzling money from the bank and the Minneapolis Treasury. So, from what I can gather, Kirsten Korkgaard was not only embezzling money from the bank to invest at Paulson Mine, but he also sat on the board of the city council of the Twin Cities of Minneapolis. And he was using money from the city of Minneapolis to funnel out and invest into ventures up in Paulson Mine. So I think that's also one of the interesting parts of, okay, why is Paulson Mine so historically significant? Well, the tentacles of this story reach out so broad. I mean, down into Minneapolis, into, you know, the banks in Minneapolis. And then it's really for us kind of a microcosm of that wider nationwide financial collapse in 1893. We have a little representative site that talks about that, you know. And I think that's, as a side note, something that makes the site really interesting.
Like a lot of rich crooks, Courtgard didn't have to do much time. Shortly after being locked up, he was pardoned by the governor. No one knows what happened to John Anderson Paulson after the mine collapsed. There's no record of where he went or what he did. No trace of him anywhere. He's a mystery man. And in some ways, it kind of makes you wonder if he ever really existed. This year, the U.S. Forest Service built a trail to help tell the story of the Paulson Mine and the Port Arthur, Duluth, and Western Railroad. The location and purpose of the trail was brought forward by Tom Caffeine. The story of the mine and the railroad first intrigued him when he was stationed up on Lake Saginaw.
When I first visited this encampment in 1984, like I said, there were some of the buildings were still standing, three or four logs high, and now you can't even tell there was anything there. This was prior to the blowdown, of course, and there hadn't been a fire in there in years, so it was very dense vegetation, lots of trees, heavy canopy, so it was very dark in the woods, and you literally had to stumble onto remnants of the Paulson Mine and the Port Arthur Railroad because you couldn't see anything out there.
Things have changed since Tom's first adventure. The blowdown windstorm swept through in 1999, knocking down most of the trees in the area. And in 2007, the Ham Lake Fire burned all that was left of the old structures. But in a way, all this natural destruction created an opportunity.
Suddenly, you could see how everything was laid out. How the railroad was laid out, how the test pits that they were testing for if there was any iron ore out there. Everything was laid out. You could see it from a distance. And it changed my whole concept of what this place was, because I had this feeling that everything was lost, never to be seen again, and all of a sudden here was history coming back.
Tom got the idea for the trail from his wife.
Being fascinated with history, I felt that this was a great opportunity to save history. And the more I walked around, the more I started thinking we have to save this. We have to figure out a way to make this accessible to the public. So one day I came home and I told my wife, boy, I wish we could save this area. And she said, why don't you build a trail? And I said, wow, that's a great idea. Now I have to figure out how to do it. But it was mostly my, let's just save what's out here so people can see how hard people worked at one time to build these mines and this railroad.
He brought the idea to the Forest Service, and they settled on building the trail to both tell part of the area story and to mark the agency's centennial anniversary. But for Tom, its meaning is more personal.
Well, it's funny. For 25 years, I've been going out there, and I'm so familiar with the area that it's kind of like going home. I saw the area when the trees were standing. I saw the area when the blowdown came down. I saw the area after the fires. And it's like visiting some old friends out there, and I'm still convinced there's things to find out there.
The trail's about a 3-mile loop. Along the way, hikers will encounter some of the old mine test pits, the former railroad bed of the Port Arthur, Duluth, and Western. And if you're really, really lucky, you might even hear the echoes of voices from a bygone era.
I think it's fascinating to walk where some place, where some people have walked earlier and done interesting things like building this railway. You can almost hear their voices as you go between the cliffs.
History Speaks, Rails, Mines, Madams, and Crooks was produced by Barbara Jean Johnson. Kelly Schoenfelder was the intern for this project. Special thanks to the Thunder Bay Museum, the Cook County Historical Society, the U.S. Forest Service, Eleanor Barr, Lee Johnson, Tom Caffeine, Stacy Lola Droulard, and the Grand Marais Public Library. This production was made possible in part by support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.